Hey, folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Marie Faustin.
He didn't know what he wanted to be when he grew up, which was crazy because he's like 35. But, you know, I think that's what happens when you date men.
That and more. But first, did you know Risk is live in Los Angeles at the Lyric Hyperion on April 16th? Well, it sure as shit is. How about hauling ass on down there, my Mickey Fickin' friends? Our LA show always gets raves, and David Crabb produces and hosts the show there, so you know it won't suck donkey dick. That's Risk Live at the Lyric Hyperion on April 16th, and the tickets are at risk-show.com/live.
We'll be right back.
Now here's the show. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. You might have noticed that something sounds a little different on the show today. Well, today is April 1st, and that of course means that tomorrow is April 2nd. I'm Kevin Allison, and if that's not enough Kevin for you, here's Kevin MacLeod behind me now with a song called Fartin' Around. Oh, excuse me. I was trying to save that one for a kinky playdate later, but now it's all yours. And we're calling this week's episode All the Wrong Places, as in Looking for Love In. Not to be confused with Wookin' Punub by Buckwheat of the Little Rascals. Not to be confused with a Wookie. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Russell Williams, who was in my well-being practices workshop last year. But before that, a story from Marie Faustin of Broad City, Search Party, and the dating game show, Why Are You Single? Marie told this one when Risk was live in San Francisco, and if you think it's fun to call it Frisco, think again, jackass. Here's Marie Faustin now with a story we call Child of Cameron Diaz.
Hey, San Francisco. How we doing? Okay, so I am a child of Cameron Diaz. Like, she's not my real mom, but even though if you squint, you could see it. But I'm a child of Cameron Diaz. Like, I grew up watching rom-coms, and I always felt like, oh, that's how I'm gonna meet the love of my life. You know, like, I'm gonna be walking down the street in my stilettos in New York City, and my heels gonna get stuck on a grate. And a dumpster is gonna be rolling down the hill, and the Statue of Liberty is gonna be falling, and a tall, sexy man is gonna swoop in and save me right before I die, and that's my man, right? Or I'm at the liquor store, and I reach for the last bottle of Sauvignon Blanc at the same time as somebody else, and there's like a zzz, and we both, and that's my husband. You know, or I get on a flight and, you know, I almost miss it because I be late, but I have TSA pre-check. I get there right before the doors close and I sit down and I don't see who I'm sitting next to, but we both reach for the armrest at the same time and, you know, the hair on my arm stand up. And by the time we land, that's my husband, right? So, but I'm not actively looking for this. I just felt like it's gonna happen. Because that's what the early 2000s taught me, is that's how you meet the love of your life. So, you know, I'm a young independent woman living in New York, and I'm not looking for men. They looking for me, but I'm not looking for them. But I've always thought, they'll find me when they need to find me. He'll find me when he needs to find me. He didn't find me. I started to kind of look like maybe he got lost. So a couple years ago, on my birthday, you know, they got me a cake and they're like, make a wish. And I said, I wish I meet my person. I know, I don't know if I'm supposed to tell you that. I don't think it's gonna come true now, but that was the wish. So for a year after that, every single man that I made any type of eye contact with, I was like, it's him. I would get in an Uber and be like, for Marie? And the driver would turn around and I'd be like, it's him. No, it's not him. the universe wouldn't send me a man who drives a Subaru. Like, I deserve better, bitch. So, but like, you know, it was like, eye contact, him? No. I'm at the bookstore, I reach for a book, I see an eyeball through the book. I'm like, well, the eye is kind of low, so maybe not him. But I knew it was going to happen, and I expected it to happen. So for a year, I just was like, it's going to happen. So there was one guy in particular that I was like, oh. I was walking down the streets of Brooklyn, right? Don't ask me where I was going. It's none of your business. I'm walking down the street. There was a guy coming the opposite direction, and he looked like a young Bob Marley, right? And I looked like this. So he was smitten, right? I felt like I was in a Dentine Ice commercial. We're like walking toward each other. It's like slow motion. Nobody's blinking, breathing, speaking. Just pheromones and vibes, right? And he stops walking, so I stop walking. And I was like, are we about to do this right here on the sidewalk? And, you know, Smittens, that's his name. Smittens was like, hey. And I was like, hey. But it was like, hey. Like, legit, if you can remember what a Dentine Ice commercial made you feel, it was like, it was summertime, but I could see my breath. It was like, this old black lady walked by. She was like, you guys look good together. I was like, I know. That's how you know it's real. An old black lady tells you. I was like, I know, we should get married, right, babe? So Smittens is telling me everything about himself, right? What he does for a living. He's telling me he's vegan. I'm like, oh, I'm vegan now, too. I don't need meat anymore. I have him, right? We're chatting. It's hot. A bus full of people drive by. Everybody on the bus is wet. That's how hot this was. So Smittens is like, he's telling me about his family, how many siblings he has, his nephews and nieces. I'm like, oh, well, how many kids do you have, Smittens? Because this is a question that, you know, you need to ask now. It's the 2000s. And he looks me in my eyeballs and said, 10 kids. I said, why are you talking to me? Take your slutty ass home. And don't make direct eye contact. I'm not trying to get pregnant. Like, ew. So clearly, Smittens was not the man that the universe had for me, right? So last year on New Year's, I usually don't perform on New Year's Eve because, you know, that's New Year's is for, you know, looking cute and doing drugs. And so, but this, for whatever reason, this show, like the time and the location lined up in a way that was like, okay, I see you, stars, right? The stars aligned. So I'm at this show and I did take some mushrooms and, you know, cause Happy New Year. And there was a photographer at the show who, like, you know, he was laughing at the jokes real hard and we kind of had a moment. And, you know, I'm a modern woman, but I typically don't like ask a man for his phone number or nothing like that. But for whatever reason, it was like, we had like a nice. And I said, okay, it's given Made in Manhattan. So I gave him my number. He called me like, oh, not called, you know, he texted me. don't call me. I'd rather write a text on a rock and throw it at your house. So this guy, we went out, he took me to get like bagels or something. It was real like, oh, okay, yes, it's giving New York. And I had a trip planned a few weeks after I met him, and he was like, do you have a ride to the airport? Can I take you to the airport? Now you know a ride to the airport is a love language, okay? So this guy offered to take me to the airport, and I was like, oh, hell yeah, you can take me to the airport, but the flight is early. And he was like, well, whatever time it is, I'll come get you. He came, he said, I'm coming to get you at 6:30 in the morning. Okay. Okay, somebody's anti-dawn in the building? Okay, big dusk crowd tonight? So he said, I'll come get you at 6:30. So naturally, you know, I came downstairs at 6:45. Well, because I'm a professional black woman, so if you... And I'm a Libra, so I'm real indecisive. I packed, and then I was like, ah, I think I need to take some stuff out and put some other stuff in. So I go downstairs 15 minutes after he's been down there. And as an apology, I bought weed. I bought like a joint because I'm a good person. And I get in the car and he has coffee, tea, orange juice. He's like, I don't know what you drink. So I bought all the options. And I was like, wow, my throat is dry. I took a sip of everything. It was nasty. But he had also bought water, so I washed it all down with that. So he drives me to JFK. And there was a moment while we were driving to JFK where, like, the sun was coming up and the sky was, like, pink and orange and, like, real beautiful, real gay. But I was like, this is, you know, it was beautiful, but, like, gay. And but we're driving toward it. We get to JFK. He parks in front of the terminal. I didn't even know you could park at the airport, but he parked. And he's like, do you want to get out and smoke that weed that you bought? And I was like, yes. So we get out to smoke. Now, I know you can't smoke in front of the airport, but we're doing it. And we're looking up at the sky, and it was just like a really, it was like a really beautiful kind of perfect moment. And I was like, all right, well, I got to go inside and catch this flight. And he was like, have a nice trip. Don't fall. And I was like, ugh. Way to ruin the moment. I said, is that really what you want to say to me? That's the last thing, that's how you want me to remember you? I'm getting on an 18-hour flight, that's how you want me to remember you? And I was like, anyway, bye. So he's dead to us, right? I'm walking into the airport like, dang, I can't believe he wrote, like, truly dead to me now. I get into the airport, I'm high, and I had these big sunglasses on. I looked like Mary-Kate and Ashley. So I'm high and blind and looking for, you know, where people with TSA PreCheck go. I'm like sliding people's babies out of the way so I can get to PreCheck. And I hear somebody behind me go, yo! And I turn around real dramatic. This man is running through the airport. I didn't even know you could run in the airport after 9/11. He's running through the airport. He comes up to me. He says, I can't have you remembering me like that. He grabs the back of my head, kisses me in the airport. My leg was like, boop. I felt like Reese with her spoon. And then he turned around and was like, have a good flight. And he just walked away. And I was like... I get on the flight, and I'm thinking about that the whole way. I got 18 hours to think about this. It was really beautiful. It turned out he was also not my soulmate. He didn't know what he wanted to be when he grew up, which was crazy because he's like 35. But you know, I think that's what happens when you date men. They can create these beautiful moments and then destroy these beautiful moments. Anyway, so I'm single-ish, but I still feel like the universe wants me to win, and I think that I'm gonna get every single thing that I want in 2024, even if I have to steal it. Anyway, thank you guys so much. single man that I made any type of eye contact with, I was like, it's him.
Baby, it's classified.
It's him. No, it's not him. It's him.
What's up, girl?
No. I deserve better, bitch. Him?
The world appears to have a green tint to it.
Maybe not him, but him.
It starts with action.
Ew. It's gonna happen. Him?
The lower your voice is, the better you sound.
Way to ruin the moment. Him?
You wanna go out tonight?
Why are you talking to me? Take your slutty ass home. It's him.
Hey, sexy, how you doing?
It turned out he was also not my soulmate. He comes up to me, he says,
you're fine.
It was beautiful, but like, gay. Him?
I love you.
No, it's not him. I think that's what happens when you date men. Anyway, so I'm single.
We'll be right back.
Do you wake up in a cold sweat from your work dreams?
Have a coworker who keeps inviting you to do escape rooms?
Can't get a coworker to agree to do escape rooms?
Or are you just genuinely not sure how to take the next step in your career?
I'm Kate.
And I'm Kim. And together we run Amy Poehler's company, Paper Kite Productions.
We've been friends and colleagues for years, so we know how important it is to feel like someone has your back at work.
And we want to be that for you.
So we're hosting a weekly advice show where we answer all your work-related questions.
Something amazing happened. I got offered my dream job.
How am I supposed to bring this up to him without hurting his feelings? What should I do?
I want to like skip the pleasantries without being an asshole.
Careful, money and friends, they don't mix, babes.
They don't. And don't work with your friends, make your friends at work.
All right, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but that was actually $1 million advice.
Whether you need advice or just love to listen to other people's problems, this show is for you.
Listen and follow Million Dollar Advice, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
This is Risk. This is apparently Johnny Lee behind me now, which I would never have known if the script hadn't told me. And we just heard an interstitial by Taj Easton about Marie Faustin looking for love. You know where. Up next, we have Russell Williams, who is just about the sweetest guy ever. He started pitching us stories a long time ago, and we fell in love with the Tao of Russell. He studied with us at the Story Studio, then worked with David Crabb and Taj on this story, and then he was in my well-being practices workshop. Russell describes himself as an artist and raccoon in human form who lives in the trees by the beach on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. In the workshop, he sent all of us a poem written in 1878 by Sidney Lanier, all about that neck of the woods. Word has it those green colonnades are full of wildwood privacies and beautiful glooms. And here's Russell speaking from there with a story we call After the Storm. No more looking for love in all the wrong places. Looking for love in too many places. Searching for us, looking for traces of what I'm dreaming of. Now that I found
I was a fatherless teenager and a teenage father. I was 17, Molly was 18, and to keep it weird, we got married and joined the Hare Krishnas. So while our old high school friends were going off to college and getting their first apartments, Molly and I were watching the sunrise over the banks of the Ganges River and singing bhajans in remote South Indian temples where there are such things as blue lotuses and little dwarf cows the size of German shepherds. So it was an interesting life. So it turns out that there is a Hare Krishna farm community about an hour from my favorite city, New Orleans. And we buy land there and build a little house in the middle of a storybook landscape there. My two daughters, they learn the names of everything that lives in the woods, all the plants and the trees and the birds, and I get to live the life of a Hindu-style cowboy. I milk the temple cows by hand every night so that I get big forearms like Popeye with muscle on muscle. So whether you're born into the Hare Krishnas like most of my friends, or you joined as a teenager like I did, or whatever, it feels like a family or a fraternity of sorts. But okay, it's really a cult. But anyway, it definitely feels like a world within a world. A group of devotees from the farm goes to India every year, and in India we travel around and meet other Hare Krishna devotees from all over the world. And in the summer, devotees from all over the world would pass through here to visit the farm. Devotees from Bengal, Australia, Argentina, France, even exotic and far off places like California and Philadelphia. So you should know, when it comes to things like fun, pleasure, sex, the Hare Krishnas fall somewhere, I would say, on the spectrum, like between the Amish and the Mormons. But down in Mississippi, we're pretty well known for being liberal, being slack, and having fun. You know, we do things like go to the movies, eat restaurant food, and drink coffee. Like today, we all spent the afternoon swimming at the lake, and now tonight, there's a big group of us younger devotees all crowded into my living room to watch a scary movie, The Others. And so there's this European Hare Krishna guy visiting, and he is good looking and a real flirt, and he is making a big show of being really friendly and affectionate with everybody. And tonight, he's making a big show of being scared by this movie. So Molly, my wife, is sitting with her girlfriends on the far side of the room, and me and this guy are sitting together on the couch. And first, he's holding onto my forearm as Nicole Kidman looks around the corner and through the mist. And then his arm is up over my shoulder, and he's burying his face in my bicep, and I can feel the stubble of his face tickling my skin, and I'm like, oh, fuck. And I have got to grab a pillow to cover up my hard on, but I do it slowly and in a way so that he pushes further into me instead of the opposite. And he must take this pillow as an invitation, because, okay, he's pushing the pillow and put his head in my lap. Okay, maybe I am a little gay. Okay, damn, I hope you can't feel that. Okay, fuck, there's no way he can't feel that. So I look around the room and I see the back of Molly's head, but everybody's watching the action on TV, but damn. Pretty sure dude is just being my bro, right? Getting comfortable like a normal person would. I mean, nothing happened that night, but dang, I realize for the first time, really, how much I was wishing something would happen, because, okay, I'm definitely gay, and that's a big problem. So I'm gay, and that's my big secret. Since I was old enough to understand what gay meant, being gay had been my big secret, and it's something that I've never said out loud to anybody, not even to myself. After my kids were born, there just never seemed to be a good time to bring it up, if that makes sense. But now we argue a lot, Molly and I, now that the kids are older. She's unhappy and I'm unhappy, and she could stub her toe on the other side of the house and literally yell out my name as if it's my fault somehow. And I wonder if it's because I'm gay. I mean, but how could she know I'm gay? I've never even been with a guy. I just have no fucking clue. Then a few weeks later, we're all gathered at the temple, the farm temple for Janmashtami, which is the biggest festival of the year. It's Krishna's birthday. The festival starts early and goes late. It's past midnight, and the air is warm and humid and filled with music and incense and flowers. My daughters are 7 and 9 now, and they're climbing the magnolia trees with their friends and pretending to be monkeys. I'm sitting in the grass with my back against a palm tree that's covered in Christmas lights, and I'm talking to my friend Julie when the kids run by with their arms outstretched like airplanes. Said, "There's a hurricane coming, there's a hurricane coming." And my friend Julie looks at me and says, "No, it's going to Florida." We sleep in late the next day, and when we finally turn on the news, no, the hurricane, it's not going to Florida. Hurricane Katrina is actually headed straight for our little slice of the Mississippi Gulf Coast. So we heed the evacuations and head to Atlanta to wait out the storm at my grandma's house, where we watch from a safe distance in the suburbs and just try and figure what the fuck is going on through the TV reports. Katrina comes through on a Monday morning, and after driving all night and hardly sleeping, we're just frozen in front of the TV all day and into the night. As everything unfolds, it's just like moving through a nightmare, because just the very rules of reality keep changing. It's like things are going from bad to crazy to just nothing makes any sense. The reporters that are there on TV in the French Quarter and in the CBD, the Central Business District, and they say that New Orleans has dodged a bullet, but the Mississippi coast is gone. There's not a building left standing. And I say, well, what do you mean gone? I mean, I don't believe that at all. My town, Bay St. Louis, is older than America. Like, cities like that don't just vanish. This is just hype. It has to be. So somehow my cousin looks on his computer and finds satellite or airplane images or something of Bay St. Louis, which is the closest real city to my house. And I look for the houses of my friends, and I don't even know what I'm looking at, because all I'm seeing are slabs and swimming pools, and it's just all wiped clean like a golf course. And as I'm looking at that screen, my heart just drops, like that weird moment before the elevator stops. And I hear Molly and my cousin let out a gasp and a sob, and I'm just feeling this low-key panic, like I need to get back home now. The reporters, they stop saying that New Orleans dodged a bullet, and they start saying there's a big problem in the city too. But still nothing is making sense. On TV, I can see that the fucking French Quarter is underwater. But no, it's okay. That's not the French Quarter. That's just a replica of the French Quarter at Six Flags. And when I see that, I think, oh no, they're cheating. This can't be happening. This is a media exaggeration. This is a lie. But it is not. It is real and is getting worse by the moment, and people are wading through the streets and waving from rooftops, and the list in my head just starts, and I'm just like going over and over the names of my people from New Orleans, my New Orleans people, my coast people. I'm like Doug, Beverly, Grace, Margo, Neil, my friends that do the pick on Bourbon Street. I remember the last time I saw Nancy, she showed me the little green parrots that played in the date palms in the neutral ground. And for me, seeing those parrots in the palm trees, that had been like seeing a unicorn in real life. And New Orleans had been like that. And so I just can't barely sleep. And when I do, all I dream about is water, water coming in and water dripping. And then the next day is Tuesday, and Tuesday, we're just busy getting supplies, batteries, peanut butter, and canned beans, and Slim Fast, and bottled water. I'm making phone calls that never get answered. I just keep busy while the news just keeps getting worse. And the only sleep I get is just uneasy dreams of water, just water dripping, flowing, invading, intruding. Wednesday morning, before the sun comes up and before the Atlanta traffic gets bad, I kiss my two daughters goodbye and leave them asleep there in the comfort and normal and safety of their grandma's house with air conditioning and TV and toys and family. And Molly and I head off into just the unknown to see if there is anything left. I'm driving fast and we're making good time. We stop for food in Birmingham, and I'm just astounded by how normal and business as usual everyone there is. But we get a little closer, and things are changing. In Tuscaloosa, about halfway there, that's the last place with gas at the gas stations. We cross into Mississippi at Meridian, and there's no gas. Maybe they have electricity? I don't know. This is the last place we see any traffic or any people, and that's where you leave Interstate 20 and just head straight south on 59 to the coast into New Orleans. So now we're speeding down the interstate like a fucking Molotov cocktail, because the trunk is loaded down with enough gas and containers to get us to the coast and then maybe right back to Atlanta, depending on what it is that we find. So this is the most intense, craziest trip I've ever taken. There are no police barricades, no signs, nothing. It just goes from civilization to war zone, like that. Molly and I are alone in the car together, mostly speechless, wide-eyed, and high on adrenaline. We're all alone on the roads, just headed straight towards the destruction. And it's exactly like a roller coaster, the way your stomach drops, not knowing what's around the bend and over every hill. And no, I'm not thinking about that dude that I talked to at that last gas station. I'm not thinking about how he smiled at me. And nope, I'm not thinking about how I specifically didn't notice how the drawstrings on his shorts fell across his cock like they were specifically designed to show off his dick. Whew, nope. Then I see a military caravan go by, olive green covered wagons filled with people in camo, little boots kicking, and I'm like, oh man, this is getting a little scary. So as we're getting closer, even the sky is changing. Every time the horizon shifts, it's replaced with a more and more broken version of itself, till I almost feel like I've left reality and gone into some alien space. God, everything is so fucked up. All the familiar topography has changed, and it looks like a mirror of my own life, a mirror of my marriage, a mirror of my own supposed faith in the Hare Krishnas. It's hard to look at. Everything's so broken. It looks unfixable. And you know, if I tell Molly the truth, for sure she's gonna divorce me. Her lawyers are gonna say I'm a pervert, and probably so will everybody in my community. My kids will get taken away from me, and I'll never get to play with them, never have the mornings and the laughing, and they'll forget about me as they grow up. I don't know. Maybe she'll accept me. We've been friends for so long. Maybe she could still love me. Maybe she would understand. I can hear Molly chanting Hare Krishna softly on her japa beads. It's been a long time since either of us did our chanting on a regular basis like we're supposed to. Chanting used to feel calming and like self-care, like a way to forget about the day-to-day stress of being a young father and maybe connect with the divine. A way to turn off anxiety, but maybe also a way to put off dealing with things that actually needed attention. Anytime there was a problem of any kind, the devotee solution had always just been chant Hare Krishna. Had I been doing my own version of Pray the Gay Away? Maybe. I think so. We pass through the big city of Hattiesburg, and it is an absolute ghost town. There's not a soul in sight. And we're getting closer, and we're almost home, and goddamn, the trees are thrown everywhere, and the light is all wrong. There's sun where shade belongs, and all the trees and even the shadows are veiny and skeletal, where it had been the thick green of summer just a few days ago. We pass an exit that must be North Poplarville, but there are no signs, and nothing looks the same. That means the next exit should be our exit, if only we can make it all the way there. And I do find the next off-ramp, but really, it's all totally unrecognizable. There are no signs, no tall pine trees covered in jasmine, no old magnolias, just piles of debris. Okay, but there's an overpass bridge, so that has to be where we have to go. That overpass looks familiar. This has to be the place. So I turn off onto an empty highway that is completely covered by downed trees. But amazingly, somehow there is this little path. A little tunnel has been cleared by, I guess, the local people with their tractors and chainsaws. It's a perfect tunnel just through this heap of downed trees. And so, okay, I turn the car forward and gas it ahead, and we inch into this tunnel with dead branches scratching the roof. And we make it all the way home like that, inch by inch through these downed trees. I turn down the driveway and I can see the shiny metal roof of my house back in the trees. And I start scanning the house like a parent counting the fingers and toes on their newborn. The house is there, but it looks like 100 years have passed. I open the car door and the first thing that hits me is the smell. It smells like autumn, but more intense. It's the smell of every leaf on every tree blown to the ground and in decay. Suddenly, my front door opens and out steps my neighbor and her son. It seems they had been sheltering in our house since the storm, and my neighbor, she looks just like Julie Andrews in a sari. She puts up both arms in the air, and she looks around, and she says, "Look, everything's fine." Well, this makes Molly angry, and she says, "What do you mean everything's fine? Fine. It's all destroyed. New Orleans is underwater. I have no idea where all my coast people are, who's alive, who's dead. But my neighbor seems completely detached from the reality of the situation in typical Hare Krishna fashion. So I leave those guys to debate the extent of ruinedness, and I keep moving, walking around the house to see what there is to see. There are a million things to do and a million things to check on, and we are running out of light. The house is fine, only the shed's gone. It's under this collapsed Jenga game of pine trees, and that's okay. Our neighbor and her son, they take off, and pretty soon Molly and I are sitting on the porch watching the sunset, and it is surreal and incredible. The missing trees on the horizon look like a gap-toothed smile. I'm just heartbroken. Then out of the pitch black comes a flash of light down the driveway, and it's my friend Manu. He's come to share a joint with us and relax at the end of the day, catch up and talk about what's happening over on his side of the farm. And after we catch up and he heads back home down the driveway and into the dark, I'm actually not thinking about the storm for the first time in a minute. I'm realizing that I've just smoked weed after being basically stone cold sober for 8 years. Molly goes inside to start lighting candles, and I'm all alone, and I just start fucking laughing. I'm laughing at myself, laughing at my little place in the middle of this huge, unfixable disaster. Everything had seemed so set and so predetermined, but none of my plans meant nothing anymore. Nobody's did. Not our plans for today, for tomorrow, or for the next day. Because before the storm, the future had seemed like a clear picture, and now it was just a box of paints. So it's months before anything starts to feel normal or easy. At night, you can see the lights getting closer and closer. The power lines are being stood back up, and finally the lights make it all the way out to our house and we have power again. Springtime comes, and even after Katrina, the azaleas bloom on cue, as beautiful as ever. They're pink and fuchsia and watermelon and white and lavender, and they're like jewels under the bent, spidery trees. And I ask Molly if she wants to join me for a chill in the gazebo in the backyard while the kids watch TV. I just want her to get on my magic carpet with me and jam on the colors in the garden and the glass half full kind of stuff. But instead it just turns into the usual black Niagara of negative and anger, and ultimately I have no fucking clue what she's even talking about. It's just our regularly scheduled fight, same old. But actually things are different today. The world has been absolutely turned upside down, and instead of just chant Hare Krishna, Molly is seeing a therapist now, and that is a huge relief because I've got my own head to sort out, and I'm tired. I'm so tired. I'm tired of the shame, and I'm tired of lying. And I know that it's not fair. I know that it's not right. I know that I'm holding an important puzzle piece in my pocket, and if I don't put it on the table, we'll never be able to finish this game and move on to one that we both want to play. So with no forethought, with no game plan, it just came out. I can't help it, and I just say it. I say, look, it's not you, okay? It's me. This, you and me, this has never worked and will never work because I'm gay. Molly pulls her whole body backwards, just like I've hocked a loogie right in her face. Her eyes narrow, and it is so painful because all of a sudden she's looking at me like I'm a stranger. And then comes the total glitch out. She goes from like disbelief to anger, a moment of sympathy, then to, who are you fucking? And then finally, how could you even want to do that with your beautiful cock? So, with those two words, I'm gay, I reshape the future and at the same time conjure up another storm that's gonna destroy just about everything that I've got left. But that's my choice. So, while everybody all around me is picking up their pieces and rebuilding, I start to rebuild too. But at first, there's this new storm on the horizon, the one that I brought, and it is tearing things up in gut-wrenching slow motion. After sort of going through the stages of grief over the death of our marriage, Molly settles into sort of constant disgusted rage, at least whenever I'm around. She's in her angry chair with a scowl and a drink and a cigarette. The divorce is awful and messy and dramatic, and if you can imagine it, yeah, it probably happened during those years, and yeah, I said years. Katrina left a horrible brokenness of houses, trees, and people, of everything all around, and in this time, this place, there's this kind of over-the-top gothic background that's always there as the soundtrack and stage set for every moment. So yeah, I fight Molly for joint custody, but I give her everything else I can. I give Molly the house, car, money, just hoping that stability for her will make things easier for the kids, because all I want is freedom, and I go and live my Walden Pond kind of life in a cabin in the woods. On weekends when the girls visit, we always have a good time. It's like camping, but with trips to the mall and the movies in between the morning hikes and the wood stove fires. I move on from the Hare Krishnas, and I move on from those old ways of thinking, and move on to new friends and find new community and confirm over and over, and in the best ways, yes, I am gay as fuck, and I fall in love. Unfortunately, Molly and I, we don't speak, but my daughters, they do remember the good times, and when my new husband, Michael, and I get married, yeah, my daughters couldn't have a better stepdad. Now, years later, my daughters are in their 20s, about the same age now as I was when Katrina rolled through, and they are both amazing and accomplished women who have made their careers working with plants and animals, a lot like me and my husband. After Katrina, I really got into urban forestry. me and another landscape designer helped our towns administer grants that were available, and we planted hundreds of canopy trees along the roads and the highways and in public spaces, and gave away thousands of free trees to homeowners and businesses. And so you just have to imagine the collective optimism that it took to plant all those little green twigs in the middle of so much death and loss. People with unlivable houses and businesses with no customers were planting trees. And now those twigs are big live oak trees that shade Mardi Gras parades and swing sets all over the city where I live. So in the long backwards glance and hindsight, whatever, was there a right answer? When is the best time to come out and do the hard thing when it's the right thing? To gamble on your truth? I don't know. I think it's a lot like planting trees. So when people ask me, so when is the best time to plant a tree? I always say, well, really the best time to plant a tree was probably 20 years ago, but second best time is always now.
This is Risk. This is his Bobness behind me now, and we just heard from Russell Williams. At the end of our well-being practices workshop, Russell wrote in to say, "The guided meditations were beautiful. I enjoyed sharing and hearing from others about what's important in their inner lives. When you put knowledge and positive energy together, there's no telling what wonderful things might grow from those seeds. It was such a pleasure to get to know all the folks in the Well-Being Practices Workshop, and we're having a little reunion party on Zoom tomorrow night. And I'm teaching the next Well-Being Practices Workshop starting May 7th, but I'll talk about that more on the next episode. In fact, I'll say more about both Russell Williams and our first storyteller, Marie Faustin, on the next episode, too, when I can speak more plainly, because I almost feel like I have a frog in my throat this week. Or that. Or maybe it's a woman. And trust me, I don't have a woman in my throat very often at all. Folks, this week on Patreon, a story by Robert Kingette.
Well, he's got very excellent penmanship, so he must know how to adequately work his penis, and therefore he knows how to be an exemplary partner in bed.
That and so much more bonus content over at patreon.com/risk. Your financial support is what is keeping the show going right now, so become a member over there. Or if you already are one, you can increase the amount of your donation if you're able to and get even more rewards. To make a one-time donation, go to paypal.me/riskshow. And thank you guys so much for everything you do to support us, whether it's donating, listening, or telling friends about the show. We could not do this without you.
We'll be right back. We're back.
Folks, this Thursday we're releasing an episode called The Best of Happy Stories 3. Unless I'm a lying sack of shit. But that's Thursday, and today's the day. Take a risk.
I'm getting up in the morning, I believe I've dust my broom. Keeping away from the women, I'm giving them lots of room. Thunder rolling over Clarksdale, everything looking blue. I just can't be happy, love, unless you're happy too. It's bad out there. I wanna everywhere.
I have compiled for you and your listening pleasure some of my favorite songs. It's all here on this unspectacular offer. But we sing. Take a whistle. Aunt Tice. Three times I made it.
Yes, they're all here.
Working for nub in all the wrong places. Working for nub.
Once Buckwheat sings a song, it's eternally his.
It died. Daddy Diver. Dan on the daddy diver. Made a Davy eye.
Order today. Send $49.95 for the full volume to Buckwheat by Ferdy Free. New North, New North.